BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, thank you for downloading the Briefing Room podcast. I'm David Aronovich. This week, everyone is talking about Sweden. So how has Sweden actually done during the pandemic, and what can we learn from it? Now look, we're nowhere close to herd immunity with the Briefing Room, so if you like the programme, we need you to pass on your appreciation to as many friends and family as possible. Let's get that S number up, that subscriptions, please. Now, enough wheedling, and on with the show. This week, as some anti-coronavirus restrictions were reimposed across the United Kingdom, a lot of people in the press and elsewhere were asking, what about Sweden? So that's our question this week. When it comes to beating the virus, should we be more like Sweden? Step into the Briefing Room and let's find out. It turned out this week that even Boris Johnson has recently consulted the architects of the Swedish pandemic strategy, a strategy that, unlike almost every other Western nation, has apparently eschewed government-led lockdown. Today, I want to know what he now knows. What have they done? Has it worked? And would it work here? Let's start with how it's been for ordinary Swedes. Here's Stockholm resident and journalist Maddie Savage with a summary of what's been happening since the start of the pandemic.
The first death in Sweden was confirmed on March the 11th, about a week after the first in the UK. And by then it was starting to become clear that the virus was spreading between communities. It wasn't just something affecting people who'd been on holiday abroad in hotspots like the Italian Alps. Italy was in lockdown, France and Spain were on their way there, and there was certainly a sense for those of us living here that Sweden might be next, might go into lockdown. There were worries about how deadly COVID-19 was, but the mood from the authorities was that they hoped to contain the virus with advice and adjustments to public life. And Swedes did go out and stock up on loo roll and food, pasta, but not on the scale of the UK. The decision to not follow other countries going into lockdown was made by the Swedish Public Health Agency rather than the government. The government acted on the agency's advice. So in this case, the decisions fell to Anders Tegnell, the top epidemiologist. His view was that this was a marathon, not a sprint, and that there was a lot to be gained from having consistency rather than going in and out of lockdown. Even though there wasn't officially a lockdown, a lot of things changed for Swedes. The same day that that first death was confirmed, Sweden banned gatherings of 500 people. That was quickly reduced to 50 by the end of March. So there have been no gigs here, no big sports events, no theatre productions. And some context, at the same time, the UK was holding the Cheltenham Festival. Liverpool was hosting Atletico Madrid. Within a few days, people were advised to work from home. Schools for over 16s were closed. But at the same time, most shops, bars, pubs and gyms remained open. Pubs were asked to offer table service only to avoid mingling at the bar. Most nightclubs chose to close down. And there was a sense of avoiding non-essential travel. It wasn't the case that all Swedes work from home, but a very tech-savvy population, strong broadband. I think a lot of that contributed to an easy switch to home working. And by the end of March, surveys showed that around 46% of Stockholmers were working from home, about 29% of people around the country. This connected very strongly to the welfare state here in Sweden. You're paid to stay at home if you're sick. Usually the first day is unpaid, but that was switched so that the government, the state, would pay for you to stay at home from the moment you started to feel ill. Another thing that's often talked about is the fact that so many Swedes live alone. More than half of all households are made up of just one person, one of the highest proportions in Europe. So there wasn't perhaps the same level of overcrowding in many Swedish households or multi-generational households like we see in Italy and Spain. Very little has changed in Sweden since March. A lot of Sweden's restrictions still are in place. Overwhelmingly, I think here there's a mood of calm in contrast to what we're seeing in many other parts of Europe.
Maddie Savage in Stockholm. So Swedish citizens haven't experienced a total lockdown of the kind we had here for a while. Remember that one-hour exercise rule? But there have been a series of lesser restrictions and a lot of voluntary locking down too. Now let's look a bit more closely at the thinking behind how the authorities sought to manage the pandemic in Sweden and what the outcome has been so far. Dr. Emma Frans is an epidemiologist and science writer who's become a familiar face to Swedes in that country's media coverage of COVID-19. Emma, can you tell me where we've got to in terms of Sweden's total number of cases of COVID-19 and the total number of deaths attributed to COVID-19 since the pandemic began?
So in total, we have 89,756 reported cases with COVID-19 in Sweden, and also 5,876 deaths with COVID-19. So it doesn't have to be the cause. If you have had a confirmed diagnosis within 30 days, you will be listed as a death with COVID-19.
So how many deaths does that make it per head of the population?
In Sweden, we have about 10 million inhabitants. So this is about 580 deaths per million.
How does that compare to Sweden's neighbours in Scandinavia, Finland, Norway, Denmark?
So our death rates are much higher compared to our neighbouring countries, and they are comparable with countries in Europe, such as France and the UK.
And what's been the most recent pattern in infections that you've seen in Sweden?
We have had quite low rates during the summer. We had quite a difficult situation during spring, but after that, the rates went down, not as fast as the countries who did a lockdown. And during the summer, we have had very low rates. And now we've seen a slight increase the last week. So maybe we're just in a later phase as compared to the rest of Europe, but we haven't seen this sharp increase like we've seen in many other parts of Europe.
From your point of view, what do you think have been the most important restrictions to bringing down the infection rate?
To stay at home if you're experiencing any symptoms, to ban larger gatherings, so we have a limit for 50 persons. People have avoided crowdings, but also banning visits on nursing homes.
What's the testing system been like in Sweden? Can anyone get a test to see if they've got the virus at any time? Is it easy?
This has been a problem in Sweden. The testing capacity hasn't been enough during spring, but now we are testing a lot of people. I think last week it was about 140,000 tests. So it's quite a large number when you look at the total population of Sweden. When complying with the recommendations to stay at home, I think people are more prone to do this if they actually have a confirmed diagnosis. I think this is very important also when it comes to people working with the elderly. I think it's also a way of getting people to come back to work earlier and also to follow this epi curve so that we know whether this slight increase in the number of cases is continuing or if we're just at a new plateau.
Half of Sweden's deaths have come from care homes. Why did that happen?
I think early on there were problems with the hygiene routines. There were problems with carers not being tested enough. This is one of the biggest failures in Sweden, that we haven't been able to protect the elderly.
One of the ways in which the Swedish experience has been described over here by some people is that the Swedish authorities gave less emphasis to saving lives from coronavirus at all costs and more emphasis on other things like saving those lives that might be lost if you did lock down, or saving those people who might get mental health problems if you did lock down, or saving the economy. Is that your perception?
The decisions were based on the strategy from the public health agency. So the economy wasn't part of the equation, but they are focusing on public health and not only on stopping this virus. We allow some people to get killed in traffic, for instance, even though we know that we could save lives by dramatically reducing the speed limit. So I think maybe other countries have been more focused on stopping the virus. And I think maybe in many other countries, they imitated China's way of handling the pandemic. And I don't think we did that at all in Sweden.
Now, when we look at the strategy overall, were there some aspects of it that only really fit a country with some of Sweden's characteristics? I'm thinking of the scale of the welfare system, for example, or the sense of community and so on.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think there's like one size fits all strategy. So I think the strategy has to be adjusted to the culture of the country, how the healthcare system works and so on. We have this kind of high trust in our authorities, and we have a culture of listening to the health recommendations. So for instance, we see in many parts of Europe a large resistance towards vaccinating your children against measles. And in Sweden, we have 97% of all parents are vaccinating their children.
Let's talk about the future. How crucial do Swedes see the coming few months as being? I mean, I imagine that in the summer, lots of people up sticks, left the cities, went out to the countryside. Is there a perception that winter is going to be a significantly different affair?
It is possible that we're just in a later phase as compared to other countries in Europe who has now seen this sharp increase in the number of cases. So, of course, we're quite worried. In the same sense, this strategy in Sweden might not be as effective in the short term, but hopefully it's something that can be sustained for a longer time. You can live with this pandemic and still follow the recommendations without having to change your life dramatically. So you can still go to work, children can still go to school, you can still meet your friends under certain circumstances. So hopefully the increase will not be as sharp in Sweden. But I don't think Sweden will go into lockdown. And I think maybe we will start to see that a lot of bans will be lifted nationally, but there might be like local restrictions.
Emma France, we've been talking there almost entirely about the health outcome of the pandemic strategy. What about the economy? Has the Swedish approach, as has been argued, allowed a better economic outcome? To discuss this with me is Richard Milne, the Nordic and Baltic correspondent at the Financial Times. Richard, what can we say about the performance of the Swedish economy since the beginning of the pandemic?
Well, I think as with a lot of things to do with coronavirus with Sweden, it depends a little bit which countries you compare Sweden with. If you look at it in the Nordic context, then Sweden looks pretty average. In fact, you know, Finland and Denmark, their economies suffered less in the first 6 months of this year. But if you look the other way, if you look towards the UK or Spain or Italy or France, then Sweden did an awful lot better. And therefore, there's this question, you know, is there something specific to do with the Nordics? I mean, one thing that's very clear is that there's much less tourism into the Nordic region as a whole compared with, say, Italy or Spain or France.
Where do we see the biggest signs of evidence that Sweden's decision not to go into total lockdown has allowed it to fare better than those that did shut up shop? Where can we compare?
Well, I think when you look at things like restaurants and bars and cafes, you saw that Sweden, in a lot of areas where a lot of countries went to zero, Sweden stayed at 80%, at 70%. And then it's a question, you know, of what's better. If you're a cafe, is it better that you stay open and you lose 30% of business and it's horrible? Or is it better that you close down, you have nothing, but then you open up and there's this sort of whoosh of confidence that comes back in. And I think that's going to be something that we're going to look at as this goes on, in that Sweden has this very steady approach, the same measures throughout, whereas other countries are having a lot more this shutting down, opening up approach. And why I think it's definitely better compared, you know, with the very sort of heavy lockdowns economically. I think you see somewhere like Norway and Denmark that lockdown opened up relatively quickly. You really see this sort of return in confidence. And so in some economic measures, they're ahead of Sweden now.
I'm interested in one thing. We lay a lot of emphasis here on what governments decide to do and government restrictions. We don't always look so much at the impact of individual aggregated consumer decisions as part of this. In other words, the fact that Swedes themselves might have changed their behaviours in some kind of way, which might act to restrict growth. Has there been any work done on that?
There are people looking at a lot of high frequency data, so things like credit card data that you can see in almost real time, you know, public transport use and things like that. And there you do see that Sweden has, in a way, had a de facto lockdown. I mean, people travel an awful lot less. The Nordic societies are very consensus-based. You know, even if it was only recommendations, that there was nothing formal, people really followed these recommendations and really changed their behaviour.
Now, in general, compared not just with the other Nordic countries, but with other countries in Europe, has Sweden's economy recovered as fast, less fast than the others?
Well, it's bouncing back pretty fast now. I think the most economists would say if you look into next year, it's probably expected to recover a bit less quickly than other countries, but that's also because it fell relatively less. So I think on average, people are expecting Sweden to get back to its sort of pre-coronavirus levels quicker. The economy in the first half contracted by a little under 10%, about 7% or something. And you're looking at, you know, in the UK was somewhere over 20% contraction. And that means eventually when the UK does start recovering, you know, the pace of trajectory will be faster, but it will take longer to get back to that early 2020 levels.
Richard Milne. So for the economy, as with health, it's a complex picture. Let's look at another level of complexity and try and simplify it. One of the big discussion points at the moment concerns whether Sweden has, as a result of its strategy, developed greater herd immunity. That is, so many people in society have been infected and protected by antibodies that the virus stops spreading. It has big implications if it's true. So is it? Joining me now is Marcus Bugert, Assistant Professor at the Centre for Infectious Medicine at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, where he's been studying immunity to COVID-19. Marcus, your research is focused on something called T cells. What are they?
Yeah, so T cells are part of our adaptive immune system that can generate a memory response against a viral infection, such as the COVID-19 virus. So essentially, you can say that you have two different parts of your adaptive immune system that people are talking, at least now, mostly about. It's partly the B cells and it's the T cells. And the B cells are the ones making the antibodies and the target viruses. And you have the T cells, which essentially what their role is to partly orchestrate immunity and provide helper functions to the entire immune system, but it's also important to kill off virus-infected cells. So they have a little bit different roles in T cells, but I think the most classical role is that they eliminate or they control the viral infections before it, for example, disseminates to the lung or other parts of the body. So that's the important role of it, is generates this early control of a viral infection.
Now, what did you discover about whether or not we could see a significantly greater resistance against future outbreaks of the virus because of this T-cell response?
To be honest with you, this is a very complex question to fully answer. And the reason for it is partly because we learn more every day about this virus. Even before the pandemic, actually, some people might have some type of protection against this new coronavirus because there has been other type of coronaviruses. They're a little bit different, but they're still similar enough so the T cells can launch an immune response against the new type of coronavirus. We thaw out blood cells from before the pandemic. We can actually see that 30% of our donors actually had already then a T cell response against SARS-CoV-2. And that's, of course, interesting because that implicates that T cells potentially can put some type of pressure on the virus in certain subjects.
There's some argument here that the fact that there hasn't been such a stringent lockdown in Sweden must have meant that more people have been infected and that actually Sweden is more likely to be approaching and will, over the longer term, approach this thing called herd immunity. What does your research tell you about this argument?
So we looked at responses about 2 to 3 months after the people became infected. So it's a pretty short time point after the people were infected. And most of the people that had mild symptoms or severe symptoms, they had antibodies and they had T cells as well. And then we have people that were living in the same households as people that were infected. And most of those people actually had antibodies as well, like 2/3 of them. And then we saw some more people having T cell responses as well. And I guess that based on that, one can start to claim that, well, if everybody in Sweden has been exposed to the virus, maybe everybody now has T cell responses. But we don't have data that really claims that in any way. What we see is that, yes, there are more people that have T cell responses maybe than antibodies. But again, is that a consequence of that they've been exposed to the virus? Maybe. But it could very well also be that they've been exposed to these old coronaviruses.
Do you have any significant evidence that there is a herd immunity emerging in Sweden?
I have to be fully honest and say that I don't see a reason for why it should be, partly because antibodies is not black and white. You might have had antibodies, you might not still have it, and you might still have it, but you might not have enough neutralizing capacity to really, you know, fully protect yourself from it. So I think, you know, this is complicated questions. The best measurement is to measure the antibodies, of course, in your body. But is that going to fully mean that you're fully protected from it? We don't know. You might for half a year, maybe.
So essentially, any big claims about herd immunity are just not justified. I mean, that's the headline on it.
That's what I feel, yes. But what I think, and I guess that most other people think, is that this will potentially in the future become almost like a cold. And they come and go basically every year, that you have peaks every season of a new coronavirus. So it's a balance here to some degree. At some point, we're just going to have to kind of face it that most likely we'll have a vaccine. We'll have to boost it every year maybe to get more antibodies. But at some point, there will be breakthroughs just like in flu and other kind of diseases. But I think that this is going to become more like a cold-like coronavirus in the end.
Marcus Bugert. And I think that means that the idea of Swedish herd immunity is unproven, to say the least. Finally, if we look at the picture overall, are there useful lessons to be learned from the very different Swedish experience? And if so, what are they? My final guest is Martin McKee, Professor of European Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Martin, in terms of policy to deal with coronavirus, is it fair to say Sweden has been an exceptional case?
I think we need to look at Sweden in the context of the Nordic countries. I don't think it's reasonable to compare Sweden with the United Kingdom or with other countries, and there are a number of reasons for that. We did a study back in 2013 where we developed a profile of public health policies across Europe in 40 countries, and the countries that came right at the top were Sweden, Norway, Iceland, and Finland. The United Kingdom came 12th. So they've got a strong public health system. They've got strong public institutions. Sweden is very different, as are the other Nordic countries, from countries like the UK and those in Southern Europe. So I don't think you can really compare Sweden with the other countries in Europe. What you can do is compare it with the Nordic countries, and there Sweden definitely has not done well.
Which would you say was the closest comparator to Sweden amongst the Nordic countries? Would it be Denmark?
If we look at the trends in mortality, all of the countries had a spike in March. And in fact, the earliest spike was in Norway. It was just a little bit earlier than the others. But Denmark and Sweden were very similar, Finland to a lower level. But then Sweden had a big spike in about June. And in the very recent period, what we've seen is that Norway and Denmark have gone slightly above Sweden, but Finland has stayed well below it.
Now, over the period of the pandemic, what can we say about comparing deaths amongst those Nordic countries?
There have been substantially more deaths in Sweden than in any of the other Nordic countries.
To what degree?
So certainly comparing it with Finland, it's about 10 times higher.
10 times higher than a comparable country which locked down?
Yes.
Despite that, do you think that there are things which Sweden has done which we could usefully look at here in Britain?
What Sweden has said, they want to focus on measures that are going to be sustainable over the long term. That contrasts with, I think, the situation in a number of other countries where there's been an attempt to go for perhaps short-term fixes in the hope that it will all be over very soon. And I think in the United Kingdom now, we're recognising that this will be at least 6 months. So therefore, whatever we do has to take that into account.
Do you mean by that, that the mentality over here had become, let's do something short and sharp and then do other small things if we need to because the vaccine's just around the corner, whereas the Swedish approach has been that may not be the answer to everything and we're in it for the long haul, so our strategy has to be even over a period?
I think the difficulty is that the UK was hit very hard early on and it did need some breathing space, so it did need to have a tight lockdown. But then there is a sense that, in fact, what Sweden didn't do was to remove the relatively limited restrictions that it had during the summer, while some of the other Nordic countries did do that. And of course, we did that as well, encouraging people to go out to eat and so on. So I think that degree of continuity that the Swedish authorities were promoting, I think, was a good one. Taking that to the UK, my argument would be, yes, certainly you need to try to open up the economy to some extent and you can release some of the restrictions, but we went too far. And that's the same in many European countries, even countries that did really well at the beginning, like the Czech Republic, for example, that celebrated with a goodbye to coronavirus party in Charles Bridge and has now seen a resurgence. So Sweden has really been quite consistent the whole way through.
Are you effectively saying that there's been a danger in countries like this that we've gone for boom and bust, whereas the one advantage of the Swedish position is its consistency and its long-term strategic effort?
Yes, I think I am. And I think that there wasn't a full appreciation here that if you relax too rapidly, then it is just going to come back again. So you need to put in place measures that will last for a long period of time. And that, I think, in Sweden would have been more than what they're doing. And in fact, we are seeing a resurgence in Stockholm in the last few days. They need to do a bit more, but I think we should have probably done rather less over the summer.
Is it your suspicion that we really won't know what best strategy would have been for really quite some time to come?
I think that we're getting closer to knowing what the best strategy would be. And I think the one thing that has changed our view, our understanding more than anything else, is the recognition that in enclosed indoor spaces, there is a real risk of transmission. And that should be pointing us towards limiting the amount of exposure that people have to confined indoor spaces where there are a lot of people mixing together in close proximity. And that's why I think we're seeing these super spreading events. Obviously, it's much easier to live out of doors in some climates than others, but I think that would be something that we could have learned maybe a little bit earlier.
If that's the case, then whichever way we look at it, we're in for a difficult few months.
I think we are in for a very difficult few months. The one good thing, I suppose, is that if we look at what happened in the Southern Hemisphere with people doing all the things that prevented coronavirus transmission, the incidence of influenza was very low. We didn't see the normal seasonal influenza that we would have expected. But that said, you can see why the government is being very cautious at the minute.
Martin McKee. And to summarise, well, one thing I found out since this programme first talked about the virus 8 months ago is that we're learning all the time. A second is that, as we heard earlier, this is a marathon, not a sprint. There are no easy answers, not in Sweden or anywhere, and it's a long haul. My thanks to my guests, Maddie Savage, Emma France, Richard Milne, Marcus Bugert and Martin McKee. That's all from us this week. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Richard Fenton-Smith, Kirsty Knight and Bob Howard. Our studio manager is Rod Farker and the editor is Jasper Corbett. If you enjoyed this podcast and you're new to The Briefing Room, then do take a look through our archive. This year we've taken a really deep dive into the coronavirus pandemic, looking at how it's affected the NHS, the economy and our mental health. We've also asked if a return to schools is a good idea and how China's relations with other countries has changed since the emergence of the virus. You can find all those episodes and much, much more on the BBC Sounds app.